How far did Greece go in planning for the possibility it might have to give up the euro? From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. As Greece's government works to enact tough new budget cuts and other austerity measures to get access to further emergency funding, there's a new controversy this week. Greece's former finance minister Yanis Varoufakis has confirmed that earlier this year, he had convened a secret team to do contingency planning to look into how to manage the situation if the country were forced off the European single currency. Varoufakis says the plans were never triggered. One of those who served on the planning team is economist James Galbraith, a University of Texas Austin professor who has known Varoufakis for many years. We reached him in Washington today. Professor, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, we know that the European Central Bank had looked at scenarios if Greece were to leave the euro, but what was this that you were involved with, looking at operational issues from the Greek perspective?
The policy of the Greek government was always to stay in the euro. And that was certainly the commitment of the finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis. And the question, though, has to be faced. Suppose Greece were forced out. What kinds of problems would arise? What would have to be done? Somebody needed to look at that, and somebody needed to look at it very discreetly, because obviously there was a set of sensitive questions.
One of the ideas here would have been to set up, what were these, parallel bank accounts, the normal euro ones that account holders had, and then other accounts that would have something else, IOUs or scrip?
There was a plan or an idea to set up a payment system inside the finance ministry that would facilitate relationships between the state and its counterparties. That was something quite separate from what we did. It was something that worked through channels in the finance ministry. And had nothing to do with kinds of issues that we were concerned with. There's been a lot of noise in the Greek press about that particular idea, but it was, in fact, has been in the public domain for some weeks because Yanis Varoufakis described it as part of his work as finance minister when he resigned.
That's an important point because you do see in the media the description here of computer hacking because the plan might have required data on the private bank accounts of Greek citizens. You're saying that was, if that went on, it was somewhere else?
No, that's not correct. This was an idea that you could use the existing systems to facilitate payments from the Greek state to its suppliers, for example.
And your project didn't take a position on Greece leaving the euro system?
No, absolutely not. But again, it would have been, as Yanis said, remiss not to worry about the issues that one would have to face if Greece were forced out.
Now, Jamie, you weren't paid for this, so why did you get involved? I guess you know the former Greek finance minister?
I've been working closely with Yanis for a number of years. He was a colleague at the University of Texas. When he became finance minister, he asked me to come over and show up, and so I did.
James Galbraith, economist at the University of Texas, thank you for this.
My pleasure.
Another story we're following this morning, news that the Obama administration wants to allow prisoners to get financial aid to further their education. Back in 1994, Congress banned prisoners from getting access to federally subsidized Pell Grants. We're also watching for quarterly results as the day wears on from the Ford Motor Company and the pharmas Pfizer and Merck, among others. The oil company BP posted a $6 billion loss this morning out of London, given the settlement for the Gulf oil disaster and the low crude oil prices. Still, some market players think BP is turning a corner now, and the stock is up 1.75%. Will be a relaxing summer day today. Let's look at what it takes to open a good bottle of wine. As part of our ongoing series called Pro Tool, we're featuring people with strong opinions about the tools they use in their work. You know, musicians always get asked about their beloved instrument. What about everyone else? Well, this morning we hear from wine buyer Lorena Asensios. I caught up with her at Astor Wines and Spirits in New York City, where she showed me her preferred device.
The waiter's corkscrew. I use it every day.
Waiter's corkscrew. So is this a big, fancy rabbit gizmo with gears and cogs?
Well, there are fancy versions of it, but I like the good old-fashioned, you know, under $10 type. It kind of looks like a pocket knife. You can fit it in your pocket, and I think that's why waiters like it so much, because it's discreet and it's small and it fits just about anywhere. So one thing I do think is important, I do like the whole ritual of opening up a bottle of wine. I like wines that have corks in them. I like using my waiter's corkscrew to open it. But ultimately, the most important aspect of this is the wine in and of itself.
This implement is not your most important tool?
No. As a wine buyer, I need to be able to taste the wine. I need to be able to smell the wine. My nose is the most important tool of my trade.
That took a lot of training?
It took a lot of training, but I certainly recollect even being a child and really being aware of what I was smelling. When I first entered the trade, I got schooled. I went to schools that teach you how to taste, how to, you know, visually look at wine, how to open wine. What are you smelling? What are you tasting? So you're schooled that way. But that was a while ago, and you work with a certain foundation that you learn, but you kind of learn a better way, what works for you.
Now, Lorena, do you get rusty if you take some time off?
I certainly get rustier towards the end of a work day, so I like to do my tasting early in the morning when I'm fresh. When I get here, 9 in the morning, I'm tasting. That's for my job, but there's a point in your life when you want to go out to dinner and have a nice glass of wine, so that's the second part of the tasting, but that's more for enjoyment. I'm not trying to assess it or scrutinize it and see if it's better.
But so you still enjoy it then?
I love it.
It's not like a busman's holiday.
No,
oh, God, don't give
me any more
wine.
I love it. I love it. But after a full day of tasting, say I'm traveling and tasting a lot, maybe at night, a beer sounds good. Because you need to maintain a fresh nature. And if you're drinking that much, it's exhausting.
Lorena Asensio is wine buyer at Astor Wines and Spirits in Manhattan. She also gave us a tutorial on the proper opening of a bottle of wine, explaining why you may not want to pop the cork. It's all on our website, marketplace.org. We've gotten wonderful suggestions from you, listeners, for other tools favored by the pros, which we'll continue to share on the air and online. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.